Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. Describes himself as the original El Mo, and he won 6 Emmys for his work as a creator, writer, animator on Sesame Street. So, you know that he was perhaps the first El Mo. He is in town, part of Sketchfest, to do stand-up comedy for children. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
This is something all parents aspire to. Dad, that's not funny. You know, I mean, we need lessons. So here he is today. His new books include Listen to My Trumpet and Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs. And, of course, the famous Knuffle Bunny. Knuffle Bunny Free, Hooray for Amanda and Her Alligator. There's a Bird in Your Head, the very famous Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus. So will you please welcome to West Coast Live, Mo Willems. Welcome to West Coast Live.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago you were here.
Yes.
And that's when you revealed your identity as El Mo.
It's Spanish for the Mo, yes.
Spanish for the Mo. And what is Mo short for, if
anything? A longer word.
which goes unspoken.
It goes unspoken, yes. Yeah. Like a woman of a certain age. That's my only secret. I need to hold on to it.
Were your parents encouraging of you as an artist, as a young man, a storyteller?
I think they were. They were discouraging of me as a person. Which makes one a good storyteller. No, I think they liked it. I had the distinct advantage of having a father who was a potter. So you can't say...
Oh, there's an applause for pottery back there.
That's right, potter, yay. So you can't say, oh, son, you can't go to film school. That's, you know, a silly career. You're not going to be making potter money. If you decide to draw books, you know. So that was a great advantage.
Yeah, good. And your mother?
Yes.
Yes, all right. So in your children's books, is there any reason that mothers show up as dinosaurs?
Well, if there is a through line to all my books, it is the one idea that childhood sucks. And I really believe that even a good childhood is that, you know, when is the last time you had to ask permission to go to the bathroom? You walk into a room, none of the furniture is to your scale. Or if you're playing like now, if we're having a good time, imagine a giant hand coming and picking you up and moving you to another room, right? And then if you complain, they yell at you. Why are you being fussy? I'm just flying you to a room away from the things that you want to be doing.
I remember when my oldest son was little enough that you could still strap him in a seat. That must have been when he was 12 or 13. No, anyways, you know, one or two, you know, and he was strapped in the seat, and he started crying because a toy of his had been left alone. And I thought, I've got to go back and get the toy. I mean, he's strapped in. He's trapped.
Right.
I don't want to psychologically damage him.
Well, you do want to psychologically damage them a little. They need to struggle somehow.
Somehow. Right. True.
What would all the shrinks do, you know?
Well, I'm sure I did that share of that anyway. So stand-up comedy for kids?
Yeah, it's going to be all these very famous comedians, Saturday Night Live guys from the state, performing my books as sketch. The idea was to have a whole bunch of actors and comedians who children should never have heard of standing in front of them performing. So it's Patton Oswalt, Janine Garofalo, David Wayne, there's all Rachel Dratch, a whole bunch. And I'm very excited about it. And then we can do a little bit of improv, and we're going to teach everybody how to draw the pigeon. And so by the end, the whole theater will be out there infringing on my copyright in a just glorious, glorious way.
We did that on the cover of our program today. We put the little pig and the elephant.
Oh, really?
The elephant and the piggy on the program. Here, you see? Here, look, see?
Oh, there we go.
But we did put on here illustration by Mo Willems.
Okay, well, that's
they're
good.
Dancing kind of insanely.
Right, yeah. I'll send that to Marcia, my agent. She'll be very interested. Thank you. Thank you for the copy, though. That's really nice.
You're welcome. Do you perform your books as you're writing them to sort of see how they come across?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is my characters yell a lot and they scream a lot. And in order to draw them, you have to be in that emotion. So, you know, we have a sign on the door to my studio that says, you know, do not feed the cartoonist. And I do. I yell, I jump, I scream. I'm very active in the books as I'm making them. It's a lot like calligraphy, and another reason why I'm on the third floor, and then that's that.
And that's that. You're sort of isolated. How long are you kind of locked into your studio before they let you out?
They do feed me. So a couple times a day, And I have a dog that really helps. Whenever something goes wrong in the studio, like my arch enemy is Printor. My printer just never prints. So when it's me against Printor, he puts on his little cape, he sits on my lap and calms me down, and then we move on.
Do you fight up against the evil Wi-Fi?
No, I don't know. Wifi. Yes.
So, if you open up the one of his new books, Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs, you find that there were a number of other possible titles scratched out. So, one of them that you discarded early on, but I am curious how far down the road you got was Goldilocks and the Three Rocket Scientists.
Yeah, Goldilocks and the 3 Mile Island. I spent a little time on. And Goldilocks and the 3 Foot Hoagie was also one. But, you know, as you were saying, I'm watching my line and eating kale, so I couldn't do that one.
How did you settle on dinosaurs? Was it something you'd... Maurice Sendak said that the wild things, he was originally going to draw them as horses, but he couldn't draw horses. Became things.
Well, I was originally going to draw these as horses, but I can't draw horses. No, you know, it's an extension, actually, of the idea of not being the right scale. That as a child, nothing is made to your scale. It's enormously frustrating, you know, being born into an environment where even the furniture says, you're nothing. We weren't made for you. We were made for important people. So this is a sense of that scale, this little girl. And it's about a girl who has no boundaries, basically, who breaks into houses on a regular basis.
But she also has never been warned and, as you point out, is poorly supervised.
She is poorly supervised, yes. She is a poorly supervised little girl. It really is. I'm crying out to America for change is what I'm doing with this book. That's obvious.
The young dinosaur comes from Norway.
Yes, well, there's a mama dinosaur, a papa dinosaur, and some dinosaur who happened to be in town from Norway. Yes. And there are lots of little signs throughout the books like, Norway, gateway to Sweden.
There's one that's very sweet. There's a couple of in-jokes. One, there's a little portrait on a table of the pigeon.
Yes.
The pigeon in there. But there's also a larger picture of a dinosaur in a hard hat with a gas drilling tower that says, we are natural gas, with a dinosaur. A chance to teach Carboniferous science.
Right? Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and the advantage of writing a book like this is that you can say things like, the first chair was too tall, the second chair was too tall, but the third chair was too tall. Yeah. So for just in the copy and paste department, it saves a lot of time.
There's one particular illustration here where the dinosaur from Norway says it made a loud noise that sounded like a big evil laugh, but was probably just a polite Norwegian expression. And I wonder, how do these words sound aloud here?
And by the way, because it's not easy to make money in picture books, all of those products are available at IKEA now as part of the Mo Willems collection.
Including the two big chairs?
Yes, exactly. That's the Hurtgen Earth, which is also good for indigestion.
So this is a really sweet story, and then it has some very good morals in the end. And I don't know if we want to give away the ending.
Well, but. I mean, I always said that I would never make a book with a moral, so this book has two morals.
To make up for that?
Right, yes. And the first one is, for Goldilocks, if you ever find yourself in the wrong story, leave. And then for the dinosaurs, which I think is the heavier of the two, is the moral for dinosaurs is, lock the back door.
Which is how Goldilocks escapes a terrible fate. Anyway, it's a wonderful, high caloric, funny story. Now, are you going to read one of these aloud? Is that what I understand?
Well, you know what? I thought Mike and I thought we would do a shortened version of a book called "Listen to My Trumpet," and I just have to say it's about terrible trumpet playing, And just coincidentally, my daughter was learning
so
trumpet.
He thought I was a perfect candidate.
Yes, right, exactly. Right, that's, and that is why I wrote it, right. So what we're going to do is I'm going to read it, and I'm going to sort of do a shortened version, and we're going to have some really terrible sounds coming out of Mike. This is like FCC terrible. That's what we're going for, right? So it's about Elephant and Piggy, who are two best friends. Piggy is an optimist. Elephant sees the glass as half full of poison. And so Piggy comes in and says, I have a trumpet. Do you want to listen to my trumpet? And Gerald says, yes, please. Oh, that's not exactly it. He goes, that's not right. Piggy says, that's not right. And then she goes, that's better. Better? Yikes. That is not music. Piggy sounds like my Aunt Molly. With a cold. And now, you got the lung for it? The big finish. So, what do you think of my trumpet? Gerald says, your trumpet is...
Yes?
Your trumpet is loud. And your trumpet is shiny. And you hold your trumpet very well. And finally, I'm waiting. He says, you hold it very well, but that was not music. And Piggy says, Gerald, you think I'm trying to make music? I am trying to speak elephant. I want to sound like you. Aww. Oh, that's nice. Thank you, moms. Thank you, moms. That's very sweet.
But you also sort of elided over a really lovely part where it says, Piggy, you are my friend, and I am your friend, so I will tell you the truth.
Yes. I believe quite sincerely that you don't write about what you know. You write about... You don't. You write about what you don't know and the struggles that you have. And for me, one of those struggles is friendship. You know, how to be honest with somebody who shows you something that is terrible. Right? Where is that line between politeness and honesty? And so that's what these books are about. They're all about things I don't understand.
Do you reach understanding after having written them, or do you just know that the question is still there and may always be there?
I think so. My job is to write 49% of the meaning of any book, and the audience puts in the 51%. And that's very important to me for some deep reasons. One, I'm lazy. So I can't be knocking out books like that if I'm doing 100% of them. And two, that I don't understand, I shouldn't understand what the books are about. My first book, Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, my first two reviews, one said, I love this book because it teaches kids the value of perseverance and never giving up and always trying. And the next review said, I love this book because it teaches kids the value of no and when to stop and give up. So to my mind, they're both right. You know, you're really bringing into it. And back to the pottery point, I think of my books as a craft, and they're a mug. And the mug has to hold the story. If it's a pretty mug, that's great. But if the mug doesn't hold the story, it's no good. So my job is to make a mug and then make sure that it lasts forever and ever and ever. These stories are not meant to be read. They're meant to be read a million billion times. Right. So they have to be strong. They have to be good mugs. Now, if they're pretty in addition, that's great. But that's not what I'm doing.
This is the, 17th in the Elephant and Piggy series?
Yeah. My daughter has braces.
And the orthodontist of the world, thank you for being such a creative person. If you'd done pottery, that might have been a different story.
Exactly, right. Her smile better be beautiful.
When Sesame Street comes on, does your daughter watch Sesame Street?
No, my daughter is past the Sesame Street age.
Is anyone really? You know, one of the interesting things about Sesame
Street. Is anyone really watching
Sesame Street? No, it's past the age of watching Sesame Street. Yeah. I mean, because now and again, I mean, if you watch the young Morgan Freeman in a sketch, for instance, I mean, it's fantastic to see him. Mm-hmm. But also, I've encountered people who have been immigrants to this country who have learned their English as adults from watching Sesame Street.
My parents learned English by watching Mission Impossible. So they would say things to me like, go to your room, you have 5 minutes.
Before you self-destruct.
Actually, true story.
I guess that's probably true for many of us watching. But when she was little, did she watch Sesame? Did you say, your dad did that?
No, you know what? There is a weird thing. My daughter has this odd thing that there. I don't think that there is a book that she has read by a living author that isn't a pal of hers. So she has a very different connection to books and stuff like that. And I think in a way that's really great because she sees it as just something that people make. You know, I think she's not afraid to say, well, that could have been a little better or, you know, whatever. You know, she doesn't say it at dinner like, you know, hey, Rick Riordan, you know that scene in the second chapter, you really could have added some punch. Or, but yeah, and television as well. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. Everything is sort of fluid in that sense. Yeah.
It's interesting that you use the word make, that books are something that you make. I mean, it's in many ways, it is a craft. It's an art. It's a craft. The way of making books, the way they're held, the way they're...
The size of them, the type of paper.
Okay, so let's talk about... I mean, listen to my trumpet. This is probably the size of an iPad mini. And the... Goldilocks, this is the size of, I don't know, a larger laptop. But what, to use that kind of metaphor, what do you make the choice about the size?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's a big thing. For instance, books that are tall tend to be like when you take a picture of somebody, you make a tall picture. Those are usually about characters. And books that are wide are usually about location. So I have a book called Edwina the Dinosaur Who Didn't Know She Was Extinct. And it's a wide book because it's not about the dinosaur. It's about how the community reacts to that dinosaur. And books that are square, like Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, are really about, like, hey, this is a weird thing. Notice this book. There's something strange about it. So the size, all of these things, the point is of making books is to manipulate your audience without them knowing it. It's a sick, sick world that I live in.
Do you ever find that the elephant or piggy infiltrate your dreams in some way? Do you feel manipulated by your characters?
Certainly the pigeon. Pigeon manipulates me all the time. Yeah, he hates it when I make books that aren't about him. He's always interrupting. He's always trying to get in there. But I mean, look, I have an odd life. I'm alone in a room writing incomprehensible books for illiterates.
You know, I have a story for you. There's a charity in England that records fathers who are imprisoned reading aloud children's books for their kids who are at home so that they can hear tape recordings of their fathers reading the stories. There is an unexpected consequence of that, which is that many of those men in prison were illiterate, and they learned how to read by reading children's books without the stigma of being embarrassed in front of their fellow prisoners. I'm reading books for my kids. It's an amazing
That's
story.
That's fabulous. I mean, you know, I do work with a group called First Book that gets books into kids' hands that wouldn't have books otherwise. And the statistics are remarkable. If you have a book in your house, you basically half as much of a chance of going to prison. You know, it's remarkable how important this is. And also the idea of read-alouds and having your kid on the lap and reading with the kid, all of that stuff. You know, I think you should read my books, but you can read the phone book, frankly. It's just that shared time.
Have you ever thought of illustrating a phone book?
No. But it's a great idea. It really is a great idea for someone else.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting idea. I think about it. You know, are there still phone books nowadays? I don't know. With Goldilocks and the three dinosaurs, do you have another? Goldilocks seems to be a possible recurring character.
Yeah, that's not. I don't really. I have a couple things that I know are series. So I have Elephant and Piggy. I will do more Elephant and Piggy books. My next picture book is sort of a silent film book, and it's called That Is Not a Good Idea, which is really about my life. And it's about a hungry fox and a plump goose, and the hungry fox invites the plump goose to the woods to help make dinner.
And where are you in this story?
I don't know yet. That's the terrible thing. Once I figure out why I made the story, I'm usually embarrassed.
Do you imagine voices for your characters?
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, you speak it, you jump up and down, you run around. It's these guys are alive to me. Certainly Elephant and Piggy, they're old friends. I love coming back and visiting with them and seeing what they're going to do. And they will change the what I think the story is going to be. They move things around. It's fun, again, being alone with a lot of people.
Or animals or creatures.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They're alive. They're alive to me.
Was there something in your life as a sort of an adolescent that you're still trying to work out?
And I'd like to do it on radio. Mom, no.
Why am I suddenly uncomfortable here?
I've always wanted to draw and be funny. When I was 5, I wrote Charles Schulz a letter and I said, "Dear Mr. Schulz, can I have your job when you're dead?" And I just sat around and waited, you know? And eventually he did pass. And it turned out my father never sent the letter. But I became buddies with his widow, who's a lovely, lovely woman, and just really great. And he really is my touchstone, because he was the only guy who was making characters who were not happy. You know, all the other pop culture characters were like mice on lithium, you know? Just overjoyed about everything. Just me, yay, it's great. And Charlie Brown, his life was worse than mine. And I could laugh at him. Yeah. And so they did, at some point, Jeannie gave me one of Sparky's nibs, which is what you put the metal that you put in the ink. And I illustrated a book with one of Sparky's nibs. And that was, for me, probably the greatest moment of my professional life.
We had the privilege of having him as a guest on our show from Ronard Park with KRCB I guess it was 95 or 96 or something. And it was a rare appearance that he made. But one of the things that we talked about, because he was a big backer of the Cartoon Art Museum and so forth, was drawing so-called cartooning as, in fact, a really serious art form.
Yeah, I think that battle has been won. Our generation is less worried about whether it's art or not. It's obviously art. But it's most important what is on the book. For me, it's about getting parents to draw again. Every night at dinner, we have a big butcher block piece of paper. We put it down on our table and we doodle as a family. And there's no such thing as a wrong drawing. And for me, it's very, very important, because drawing is a form of empathy. When you're drawing a villain, you're thinking about that villain. Oh, he's got a cape. Why does he have a cape? Because he's a really nasty guy. And oh, he's got this and whatever. And you start to empathize with that character. So it's a form of physicalized empathy. And, you know, not to get too heavy, if there's one thing that this world could use just a little bit more of, it would be empathy.
That's a pretty heavy thought.
Right. Yeah.
How do you... I like the idea of the butcher block table. Plus, it's an easy way of cleaning the table at the end.
Absolutely. And, you know...
Do you save these kind of tablecloths?
When Eric Carle comes to dinner, sure. But no, not ours. The point is actually just for them to be doodles. Every now and then there's a drawing that you'll keep because you like or something. But you know, as my daughter is aged, you see her working through whatever issue she's going through those drawings. There are things that she can't necessarily talk about, but you start to see the drawings. Well, why are you drawing that? You know, and that's not just her. For myself as well, I've been drawing for the last 2 years commuting penguins. There's something there.
Yeah. And you have empathy with people who commute, since you don't, it sounds like.
Yes. Maybe that's it. I have no idea. But there's something really compelling about drawing these penguins in various modes of transportation, trying to bring their fish home.
You know, that sounds kind of like Richard Scarry and all those people of Busy Town who, right. you know, Mr. Pickle and, you know, all those other characters who was the lowly worm who hops around on just his stump.
That's right. Yeah. So, but the point is, you're just doodling. You don't know why or what you're doing. And I think that's great. And even for somebody who draws for a living, I don't get enough time just doodling, just letting it come out. And at some point, most people realize they're not going to become professional basketball players. And it's usually the same week that they realize that they're not going to be professional cartoonists. And they stop drawing, but they don't stop playing basketball. Right? That you still do hoops in the backyard and stuff like that.
But they're not doing drawing hoops on the table.
Right. And that's what I would like to encourage. I think that you should still be doodling, and particularly if you've got kids. If you say to a kid, like, hey, you should really draw, and then you don't, they know you're lying. They know it's for babies. They're not stupid. You know, they're just shorter.
I was thinking about, you know, you're doing this stand-up comedy tomorrow, in a way. And I, as I've watched my children grow, I can see that their senses of humor evolve and the ability to move from, you know, something that's, say, kind of concrete and obvious to something a little more abstract and conceptual. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an interesting sort of gradation. I don't know if it happens instantly or not. When you think about the humor in your books, does that how kids react to humor?
I'm lucky because I write for children, so I only have to write about jealousy, hatred, love. wanting to drive a bus. That's my path.
You and Dostoevsky. Right.
No, absolutely. It's very existential. And if you're an adult comedian, you've got to think about the Eiffel Tower or who had a Pop 40 song and all that stuff. I don't particularly participate in my culture. And if I was writing comedy for grown-ups, I would have to watch this stuff. Yeah. You know. So for me, it really is just jealousy, hatred, love, passion. Those are the things that children live with every single day. And because those emotions are new to them, they just got them in the mail. They're brand new. They're that much fresher and stronger than they are for us.
I hope you have a chance to go out and hear Mo Willems' stories read aloud, brought to life by these comedians, or pick up three or four of his copies of his books. Mo Willems, thank you very much for
being here. Thank you. It was great. Take care, guys.
Mo Willems. Here on West Coast Live. His new books include Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs. Listen to my trumpet. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.